You ask, I'll try and answer.
Oh, by far the former tests. So I now have a draft of the exam, and I was very uncreative. So I mean, which is different from saying not totally creative. I made a handful of new drawings, but there are lots of exact repeats from previous exams, lots of approximate repeats from previous exams. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, yep, we can. Okay. But I'm kind of wondering what a Carnot cycle problem is.
Or just like one similar to what we're
looking for. Yeah, so on the test, what we had was a problem, which I wouldn't call it wasn't a Carnot. Well, so we had two test questions that maybe we were thinking about. One of them had a table of U and S, and we calculated with it.
Yeah.
And the other one was one that had a Carnot cycle, but I had you describing it either with that kind of map that shows energy flows or on a PV diagram.
I was on the second of the refrigeration one.
The last question on the last exam.
Yeah.
And the last part of it? Or the first part of it? Both parts of it. Most people had problems with the second part, and I don't know, for me, maybe the lesson is not to give you choice, because I think it made a real difference which one you chose. The people on average scored a lot worse on part B than they did on part A. So you can correct me, I may have things wrong, but I think what I had is a graph that looked kind of like that. And I think these were labeled A, B, C, D. And I probably had a chart that had, can you tell me what the entries on the top were? Yeah, so they had the top was change in T, change in U, change in S, Q and W, and then for the various paths. So I think we had to put in signs and we had to identify. So the a heat engine as opposed to a refrigerator has to do net work. And the work that the gas does, as opposed to the work we do on the gas, that is to say minus W, that's what we would normally call the area under this curve. So we would get a net area under this curve if we went around that way. And that would be a heat engine, as opposed to a refrigerator. So we must be going around the other way if we've got a Carnot refrigerator. We're good? So Carnot cycles consist of isotherms and adiabats. So the adiabats are where the temperature is changing. That's going to be B and D. And the isotherms are where the temperature isn't changing. Those are going to be A and C. So pretty much immediately, we got no change in temperature for those guys. And for an ideal gas, the internal energy changes only if the temperature changes. For A, we are going to have to do work compressing that gas. So as opposed, got to be real careful, difference between the work that we do, which is what we're using the symbol W for, and the work that the gas does. So we do work, which is what W means, so that's going to be positive. This plus this have to add up to that, which is zero, so this guy has to be negative. And delta S is Q over T, so if Q is negative, delta S has to be negative. Contrary wise here, the gas is doing work, which means that W is negative. It adds up to zero, so this is positive and this is positive. Okay, so the adiabats are D and C. This is the one further out, so this is hot. And this is cold. So for D, we're going from hot to cold, which is a negative change in temperature, which means that delta U has to be negative. By definition, adiabats have no Q, and therefore no change in entropy. And you can see that for D, I have expansion, so the gas is doing work, which means that that W is negative. For B, I'm getting hot. So this is positive, this is positive. It's an adiabat, so this is zero. And you can see that I'm doing work, so that's plus. So, yeah, people screwed this question up lots of ways by not figuring out which one were isotherms and adiabats. If you just get that, you're going to get lots of points, right? Because the isotherms are going to have these things being zero, and the adiabats are going to have those things be zero. And you got about half of the points then just from that. And then the other thing that people went wrong on is which way you go around the cycle. Obviously, if you go around the cycle, all these signs are going to be reversed. If you go around the other way, the cycles are all going to be reversed.
Did you say isotherms have delta T and delta U as zero, and then adiabats are delta S and Q as zero?
So what is absolutely always the case is adiabats have Q and delta S being zero. What is absolutely always the case, isotherm means same temperature. So that has to be zero. For an ideal gas, but only for an ideal gas, the internal energy just depends on the temperature, and so we'd get delta U being zero. But for like that steam problem, when it's not an ideal gas, then there was a change in the internal energy, even though there was no change in temperature.
So, yeah, adiabats by definition are when there's no entropy change, right?
Yes.
So, by that, there's no heat change.
There's no what?
Heat, Q.
Yes. And I think, so you can pay your money and take your choice. What the book said is that an adiabat is where Q is zero, and therefore the entropy is zero. And what you just said is adiabats are where the entropy change is zero, and therefore the Q is zero. So, yeah, you can go it either way. And obviously entropy was introduced later in the book, so they didn't want to hit you with that right off the bat. And I guess the other thing I would comment is practically speaking, adiabats are usually fast. That is to say, the way you achieve Q equals zero is by having a fast motion so that there isn't time for heat to escape. So like a statics problem?
Yeah.
So
like maybe one of the bear on the ledge with the string.
So I can't remember anyone in particular, but let's put bears are hard to draw. Let's put Rupert. He's about to jump off this flagpole. And it's actually a pretty thick flagpole. Rupert weighs 75 kilograms, and the flagpole weighs 25 kilograms, and the flagpole is 5 meters long, and it's supported by a string that's at 45 degrees and connects at the midpoint of the flagpole. And we're supposed to figure out what the tension in this string is. It's a pretty typical problem. So the first thing you want to do is identify all the forces and where they're acting. So Rupert, he has a weight, so that force is going to be the mass of Rupert times G acting at that particular location. The one thing that's important to remember is that for an extended object, we can treat it as if it were a point mass at its center of mass. So we can treat this whole object as if it were right there. So we're going to have the mass of the pole times g acting at 2.5 meters. And there's going to be, of course, we've got this obvious tension force that is acting at 45 degrees that we want to calculate. And we have some kind of funny force that's acting at this spot here.
Is that saying this pole is 25 kilograms?
The pole is 25 kilograms. So there's going to be some sort of force at this hinge, and we can kind of sketch it up. It has pretty much has to be pushing up, and it has to be canceling this, because the sum of the forces in the y direction have to be zero. But we don't certainly currently know what this is. So I don't know what we call this. Support force. So for a torque problem, the first thing you want to do is to choose an origin. And you typically want to choose the origin where something that you don't know is active, because then it'll be eliminated from that equation. So for this sort of problem, this is the usual place to choose the origin, because it eliminates the torque due to that unknown support force. OK, so once we've done that, what's the definition of torque? Well, we had lots of definitions of torque. One of them was the force times the distance times the sine of the angle between them. I also like this version of it. It's the force times the moment arm, the perpendicular distance from that line of action of the force. So both of those are useful. And typically, although we don't have to, we take torques that are twisting counterclockwise to be positive. So if we do that, here we have the only torque that's trying to twist us in a positive direction. And it's nicely set up to use this version of the torque equation, because here's the angle between them, 45 degrees. So that torque is going to be plus the force, which is the unknown tension T, times the distance, which is 2.5 meters, times the sine of 45 degrees. Then we've got this torque, which is negative. It is nicely perpendicular. So you can either say that the sine of 90 degrees is 1, or you can say that our perpendicular is 2.5 meters. Either way, we're going to have a force that is 25 kilograms times g times 2.5 meters. And finally, we've got Rupert, who is sitting out at 5. Weighs 75 kilograms, so has a weight that is 75 g, and is sitting out there at 5 meters. So statics tell us that it's not rotating, so the sum of the torques have to be zero. So that's an equation with one unknown. And if I can, I'll quit there. It's plug and chug pretty much from there. How about if we wanted to calculate this support force? Sometimes we've had problems like that. Yeah, so what is the force that's acting at this point? We got rid of it in the torque equation by choosing our origin there, but maybe we want to know whether it's big enough to break that hinge or not. Well, what has to be the case, we've already calculated tension from over there. What has to be the case is the horizontal piece of this force has to be balancing the horizontal piece of the tension. Those are the only forces in the x direction. So this force has to be pointing that way with a magnitude that is t times the cosine, because this is an adjacent sine of 45 degrees. The sum of the forces in the y direction have to be zero. So this piece of this force, Fy plus this piece of tension, which is the tension times the sine of 45 degrees, minus the mass of the pole times g, minus the mass of Rupert times g, the sum of those forces have to add up to zero. So we could get then what the hinge force in the y direction is. The rules of statics are the sum of the forces in the x direction have to be zero, the sum of the forces in the y direction have to be zero, and the sum of the torques about any origin you choose have to be zero.
Mm-hmm. Which way is the force in y point? So it's pointing straight up, that force in y of the support force.
Yeah, so I've broken this support force, which is at some unknown angle, into two pieces. A piece that is vertical and a piece that's horizontal.
Okay. Where was the origin on this one?
So you can choose the origin any place you want. So I didn't use torques, right? I was using forces. So forces don't have origins, so I don't have to worry about it. But I can choose the origin any place I want.
Is that first value positive or negative?
What's the first value? Here? This one? This is positive. Because it's trying to twist it counterclockwise. Everything else is trying to twist it clockwise. So you're talking about the thermal conductivity? So in general, the amount of energy per second, joules per second, which is power, that is coming off of a slab of material depends on the area of that slab of material. So think about the size of a window, for example, times the change in temperature over the thickness of that material, and then all of this is times the thermal conductivity of that material. So where most people went wrong on this equation, or at least lots of people went wrong, is they saw an L and they immediately thought latent heat of fusion. That's not the L, that's the thickness of whatever it is that the stuff is going through. So if this tabletop were the piece of ice, then that L would be this thickness. And in that exam problem, it was about like that. It was about 2 centimeters thick. So the problem asks how much ice is formed under a square meter. So the area I'm talking about is 1 square meter. The problem told us what the thermal conductivity is. I certainly don't remember it. The temperature was, I don't know, I think it was minus 20 C on top of the ice, and of course it was 0 C below the ice. So the temperature change was 20 degrees Celsius, and the thickness of the ice was 2 centimeters. So from this equation, we get how much heat is being sucked out of the lake every second. And the question asks how much ice is formed in an hour. So first of all, we want to figure out how much total heat is being withdrawn, and that's going to be the power times 1 hour's worth of seconds, right? 60 minutes, 60 seconds, 3,600 seconds of time. So we're going to get that many joules of heat that are withdrawn, and we can set that heat equal to the latent heat of fusion times the mass of ice that's going to be formed. Right, so I don't know, this is, I think, 3.33 times 10 to the fifth. So we could solve then for the mass. So figure out what the heat is by using thermal conductivity, and then all of that heat is going into freezing ice. And it takes 300,000 joules per kilogram in order to freeze ice.
Or can you answer that?
Well, I guess I don't distinguish between the problems at the beginning and the end, the problems. I never think of ones. I didn't think that the ones at the beginning are harder than the ones at the end. So
the one that was in my head was like the school, the from the second exam.
Yeah, that was a harder problem. I agree.
Okay. Is that going to be on the file?
Might be.
But all those kind of questions are fair game, not
so. Yeah. Everything's fair game, right? It's a final. And what I'm telling you is that there are lots of repeat questions, and that would be a repeat question, right? So it would be fair game. I don't know. So if you want to take the flip side of it, kind of the good news is if you figure what adds up to 9, there are about 2 questions from every exam, right? So. Yes, there in the current draft, it's pretty much like I told you. There are 24 multiple choice questions and 9 problems.
Can we go over the steam problem from the last
one? So that's the pretty complicated problem. Somebody have their exams? So what we need are numbers in order to solve this problem. We have a PV diagram, which you know doesn't look all that interesting. What we've got is an isobar. We have an expansion at constant pressure. We have an adiabat. That's where the steam is going to drive the turbine. And then we have an isotherm. And we want to go around that way if we're going to have a steam engine, which is what this is supposed to be. Now, this is steam, so we can't use PV equals NRT. And if you don't believe me, you can take 0.1 and calculate. I've got the pressure and the volume, and you know it's 1 kilogram, so you can figure out how many moles there are. You can happily calculate PV on one side and NT on the other, and you'll see it doesn't work. Steam is not an ideal gas. So what we have to do is we have to use the stuff that's on this table. So what is the foolproof stuff, the stuff that doesn't depend on something being ideal gas? Well, the laws of thermodynamics are good examples, right? The change in U has to be Q plus W. Always true, doesn't depend on it being an ideal gas. And the other equation we have is if we have an isotherm, then the change in entropy is Q over T. So I think those are the only things that are, well, okay, so we have also, if we have an isobar, then the work is going to be minus the pressure times the change in volume. The work is always basically the pressure times the change in volume, but if it's a curve, then the pressure is changing while the volume is changing, and it's hard to get the area under it, right? Whereas if this is a straight line, it's very easy to get the area under it. So what is always true is this is minus the area under the curve. It's just that this area is particularly easy to calculate for an isobar. Okay, so those are always true statements. What do they ask us for? Well, so they start out by asking for the work that the steam is going to do in the turbine. And the turbine is this adiabat. And the adiabat, of course, has Q equals 0. So the work is just going to be the change in internal energy. So all we need to do is to subtract the internal energies before and after. So the final internal energy is 4452 and the kilojoules. And the initial internal energy is 2545. Oh, good, I did it wrong. I was wondering about that. Okay, so sorry. This adiabat starts at 2, so the final is 4450, excuse me, the initial is 4452, and the final is 2828. Right, we're going from 2 to 3. We seem to be getting a negative number for W. Well, good, right? Because the steam engine is doing work, so we are expecting to get a negative number. So the work that the steam engine does is going to be minus W. So it's just going to be the opposite of this change in internal energy. How much work is done from 1 to 2? Well, 1 to 2 is an isobar. So this is the work that we do, and it's asking for the work that the steam does. So the work is going to be plus P times delta V. And the problem tells us that P is 10 megapascals. Lots of people forgot their mega. And the change in volume we can calculate, because the initial volume is 0.01803, and the final volume is 0.06789. So then it asks how much Q, how much heat did we have to add in this little isobaric section? Well, we can calculate delta U because we know U at the beginning and the end. We just calculated what W is. So W is minus this, right? So we can calculate Q. And we're expecting a positive number, right? We're heating the gas at this point. So I'm expecting Q to be a positive number. So last question says, how much heat do we have to remove in going from 3 to 1? Well, that's an isotherm. So I can calculate the heat by the change in entropy times the temperature. So the final entropy is number 1, and it's 5.6159 times 10 to the third kilojoules. And the initial is 8.2124 times 10 to the third. So I'm going to get a negative number because I'm pulling heat out of that steam. Okay, so these are the statements that don't require an ideal gas. In that big chart I gave you, where we had things like Cp times delta T, those depended on it being an ideal gas.
What did you do for the third part?
So for the third part, it asks how much heat did I have to take out of the gas in this isotherm? And since it's an isotherm, I can use this equation. We know what the final entropy is, we know what the initial entropy is, and we know what the temperature is. So I think we do need to add, it's 311, isn't it, is the temperature in degrees Celsius. We do need to remember to add the 273 to get it in Kelvin. So kind of what was that? Ah, that's the spool problem that somebody was asking about earlier. So this is, you know, kind of one of those free body diagram sort of problems where the plan is to figure out, it's a rotational problem, so we're going to be talking about torques, but kind of more generally the idea is to look at all of the forces that are active and then set the sum of the forces equal to the mass times the acceleration, get a couple of the equations, and then solve them, and off to the races, right? So that's kind of the background for how this sort of question is going to work. And what we have here is a spool and a hanging mass. and we're told that the inner radius of the spool is 1 centimeter, and the outer radius of the spool is 5 centimeters, and there's a frictional force that's acting on the edge that is 0.6 newtons. And they also tell us the moment of inertia of the spool, 0.004 kilogram meters squared. And this hanging mass is 0.75 kilograms. And we're supposed to find the acceleration of the falling mass. I think that's all the numbers. Okay, so for the falling mass, it's not rotating, so we can set the sum of the forces equal to the mass times the acceleration. What are the forces acting on it? Well, there's gravity, mg, and there's some tension that's pulling it up. So we have then that if we, it's convenient to choose a direction that the motion is actually going to be in, and it's going to fall, so I'm going to choose down to be the positive direction. So mg is then a positive force, and the tension is a negative force, and that has to equal the mass times the acceleration. Now let me kind of look down on this circle. So what I have is this tension that is trying to rotate this thing that away, and I have a frictional force that is trying to rotate it the other way. And kind of what Newton's law says is that the sum of the torques is equal to I alpha. So let's call this a positive torque. So we have T times lowercase r trying to twist it in that direction, and we have the frictional force times capital R trying to twist it in the other direction, and this has to equal I alpha. Sum of the torques is equal to I alpha. So we know M, we know the frictional force, we know lowercase and uppercase R. We don't know the acceleration, we don't know the tension, and we don't know alpha. So we're not out of the woods yet because we have 2 equations and 3 unknowns. So we need something else. And I hope it's clear there's a connection, there's literally a connection between this thing rotating and that thing falling. And under those circumstances, what we said was that the distance that something moves is r times the angle, and the velocity that something has is r times omega, and the acceleration that something has is r times alpha. Okay, so when things are connected by strings, how much string comes off depends on how much the thing has rotated. And those are the relationships that are true. And I remind you that these things all have to be measured in radians for these equations to follow. So if you were measuring your angles in degrees, or your omega in revolutions per minute, or your alpha in who knows what, you'll be in trouble unless you're using radians. Okay, so they ask us about acceleration, so let's get rid of alpha in favor of acceleration. Alpha should be a over lowercase r. So now we got 2 equations and 2 unknowns, and you can kind of pick your favorite way to solve them. You know, I always like to solve things by arranging it so that things cancel when I add them up. And I would be good if I divided this whole equation by t. Or excuse me, by r, then I would have a plus t here and a minus t there. So when I added them up, they would disappear. So let's see how that's going to work. So I'm just going to recopy the first equation, not change it at all. But for the second equation, let's divide everything through by r. So then I'm going to have t minus the frictional force, that's the 0.6 newtons, capital R divided by lowercase r. That's equal to I over R, and then alpha is A over R. Yes?
Right after T minus, what is that first thing on the left?
So that's a F sub F. That's the frictional force that they tell us is 0.6 newtons in the problem. The break. Okay, so I arranged it so that when I added this thing up, I'd get rid of that unknown. So what I've got is mg minus the 0.6 newtons, the ratio of the radiuses, and I've got a as a common factor so I can factor it out. So I have m plus I over r squared all times a. So if I divide that parentheses thing through, I've got acceleration, which is what they asked me about. The acceleration is the force that's pulling it down, and then a fraction of this frictional force according to kind of the lever ratio between where it's acting and where the other force is acting, all divided by something like the effective mass. And on the left-hand side, we know everything, right? This is 0.75 kilograms, and g is what it always is, 9.8. This was 0.6 newtons. This was 5 centimeters. This was 1 centimeter. Notice there's no reason to convert those to meters, as there usually is, because this is the ratio of those two, so the units will cancel out. So why bother to do that? And the moment of inertia was 0.0004. And this is now this one I do have to convert to meters. So 0.01 meters squared.
For there, aren't you already A over R? When you go I alpha, which is A over R, then you divide it by R again, that would be R squared.
Yes.
But isn't that like kind of one right above there? It would be R squared, there too.
There are two of them.
But wouldn't it?
R times R is the same thing as R squared. So this R is that R, and this R is the divided is what I divided everything through by. More questions? So because I'm lazy, I use lots of, so I would intend not to overstress it, the material we've done in the last cycle. But I probably, in fact, understress it because, you know, I've got all these questions that I love from the old exams. So I would say there's less than the appropriate fraction of stuff that's on the new material. There's some, but not, certainly not overstressed, probably slightly understressed.
Where was our stopping point, 14.1?
Right, so I wouldn't say that, so there's one section in 14, which is the standing waves on strings, and I don't think it's 14.1, it's maybe like 14.3 or something like that.
Okay. So what are your favorite questions from the previous class?
Well, I'll tell you on Monday. You don't want to open your Christmas presents before they're due. Just think of the excitement when you come down. Well, you've been shaking the box, haven't you?
I think we should compromise and like open one present.
One present every day until
Christmas. Well, so I'm pretty sure that on the board I've worked at least one problem that is pretty much an exact repeat from that I think I've worked on the board at least one problem that is on your final.
Okay. Which one?
That one. The one that's behind me.
Do you have any of these up on screencasts?
As far as I know, everything is up on the screencast with the exception of quiz 11.
The multiple choice from the third test, I don't believe was on there. I don't know, you had gone over multiple choice from like test 1 and 2. Would it be possible to put the answers to the multiple choice to test 3 online?
I will be very surprised if it's not online.
Maybe I just didn't see it. Well, I know there's like a PDF with all the questions.
No. It is my intention. And my intention sometimes isn't accurate. It's my intention that everything is in a screencast except quiz 11, and I kind of hope to get to quiz 11, but I haven't yet. And for these screencasts, I know it takes a while, but I think your benefit by actually downloading them as opposed to playing them live. Because that way, if it's boring, you can just skip ahead. And if you want to hear it again, you can go back. So they're pretty big, but that would be my recommendation. Do it on campus, for sure. So the question is, test 3, multiple choice? So there's certainly a file that has the right name, so the only question is whether it's it seems to be not protected and actually relatively short. So kind of the naming scheme for things are 105 and then 12.mp4. And then what would go here would be either Q or T and then the corresponding number. And so this one here is T3 capital MC. So I think that that's not a bad way of getting a handle on them. So one of the problems, of course, is the answers aren't there. But I think that's not a bad way to look at the first part, the multiple choice questions. I bet, I don't know this for a fact, I bet that some of those are exactly repeated on your exam. Can you take it right now? Yeah. Do you really want to? I would probably let you. I don't have a clean copy of it, but I could come up with a copy.
Why don't you come down to
that? No, that is coming
to you. You do it first.
Can we take it now and then average our grades? Take it twice?
I don't think so. I'd have to grade it twice.
I'll agree.
So you're trying to open your package on Christmas Eve, huh? So I will be here Saturday, so if you have questions, you can email me or come in on Saturday.
Can you give us hints?
Hints of what's going to be on the exam?
Yeah.
That's what I've been doing.
see if we can work through
that. No, I don't think so.
Can you post an exact episode of the final online somewhere?
Do you have any practice?
Like, if you want to take the time to find it, we can.
Hide it, huh?
Not too hard, though.
I'll make it only readable under Linux operating system, and I'll hide it. Okay, questions? Real questions, not trying to worm information out of me.
We didn't talk much about the bulk modulus. Is that so kind of, we don't really need to know that one. It's more Shear and Young's.
So, I mean, why would, I don't think I'm letting the cat out of the bag to say that that's not going to, none of those are going to be problems, right? So those things are only going to occur as multiple choice. And I'm not sure I see a big difference from how much we talked about all of those moduluses. I would think any of those are fair game.
Bulk just never came up in any of those.
Hmm.
Like
I think it
like,
did.
It's like complete expansion.
Yeah, didn't we have the salt water that was way underneath that we had to find the density of? I remember a problem like that. It was either worked in class or it was a homework problem. Say again?
Does anyone have this room checked out after you?
I don't know for a fact. But I think it's checked out till like 5 or probably checked out till 5. My guess is that it's open. Adam's already had his review session, so the big classes have met. Did people pick up their quizzes?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I got it.
They left. No, I don't think so. You see it. Josh is here, isn't he?
Right here.
You're not Josh.
Oh, Josh. Do you have my test from...
I should, if you have anything that didn't get handed back, I should have it. Is Jack still here? No, he left. Yep. Yeah, where? You want, you've got a, got it something. I saw your name on it.
Right there.
That's an important quiz to have. Mitch, the other Josh.
Me.
John, that's the one you were looking for?
Wait, was there a quiz? I think I might have got a quiz. And back already. Yeah.
So these are the I quizzes. Kelly.
Yeah, it doesn't. I think I have all mine now.
Yeah. Lots of stuff from Kelly. Rich, is he still here? He left.
Thank you.
There's another quiz for Josh.
Oh, that's what I was thank you.
Julie left.
Josh.
No, it was the other Josh. Wait, but there was something I thought. Did that get to you?
I just picked up the latest.
You got that quiz, right?
Yeah, I have that.
Yes, okay.